This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to GEICO.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
Embracing the criticism. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
Supporters of President Trump believe that those who are dismissive of his early decision-making are validating the reasons he was elected to shake things up.
Want to save money? Make your own household staples like deodorant or laundry detergent. Find out who's doing it and how it's done.
How does the world's richest man preserve his wealth? One way is by carefully selecting which breakfast sandwich he has at McDonald's every day.
And the revenue source for craft breweries. Customers now lining up for hours to buy the latest versions.
Yeah, typically you think of buying beer, you think you're going to go to a grocery store, you're going to go to your liquor store and you're going to pick up a six-pack. But there's been this sort of an on-premise revolution where breweries have increasingly started selling beers directly out of their facilities.
New York Times writer Joshua Bernstein on diehard fans camping out even to get just one can of a new ale. Beer talk in about 25 minutes. President Trump's first 3 weeks in office have been met with protests, outrage, sometimes indignation, and that's just fine with his supporters. In fact, Niall Stanage, White House columnist at The Hill, says Mr. Trump's backers see the blizzard of criticism as proof he's doing exactly what he said he would. Niall, what are you seeing?
Well, I think, Gordon, what we're seeing is President Trump and his team seeing the outrage that greets them as evidence that they're doing what they were elected to do in the first place, that they are following through on the promises for that were made to their voters, which in turn is engendering criticism from liberal critics and from the media to some extent.
All right. So you wrote, too, that skeptics caution that Mr. Trump's embrace of controversy is a dangerous game. Explain why.
A couple of reasons. One is if he is getting into a sort of a polarized game of just taking care of his voters and not anyone else, it's not at all clear that his voters have a plurality. The second part of it is just on policy terms. We've seen some things like the controversial phone call with the Australian Prime Minister that clearly disconcerted some of President Trump's colleagues in the Republican Party as well as other critics.
Is that to say that, this could wear people out, this type of approach?
I think it could. I mean, it clearly is not an approach that seems to be reaching out to the middle ground to any great extent. It's very much reliant on a base strategy, as we say, in politics. And whether that is sustainable over the long run is open to question, especially since all presidents run into turbulence, whether of their own creation or of regarding events.
Yeah. All right. You point out, too, that Mr. Trump supporters are adamant that the voters who put him there in the White House could care less about these diplomatic niceties or Washington protocol.
That's right. And thinking here of things like that phone call with the Australian Prime Minister, the people who are close to Trump simply don't think his voters care. They think that they, to a certain degree, take pride in his willingness to flout the usual conventions, and that therefore it does him no real political damage.
We're speaking with Niall Stanage, White House correspondent, or White House columnist, rather, at The Hill. His piece is called Trump Embraces Critics' Outrage. Explain, though, on the other side of the coin here, Niall, why this approach could work.
Well, it could work because it could energize the people who voted for Donald Trump in the first place. It could also perhaps sort of incite his critics and enemies to overreach, whether that be through demonstrations or civil disorder or anything of that nature. And it could simply prove to the people who voted for President Trump that he is following through on his promises. That has always been a part of his appeal, that he tells it as he sees it and operates outside of the usual political norms.
The fact that his popularity numbers are down, as you point out, is that something else that most of the supporters don't care about at this point?
Well, I think that they are skeptical of opinion polls in large part because, of course, the opinion polls, broadly speaking, predicted his defeat in November's presidential election, and were clearly wrong. So they, at the moment, don't put all that much store by opinion polls, but I do think that if his approval ratings stayed where they are or continued to go down, that would be a problem, not least because it wouldn't encourage his Republican colleagues on Capitol Hill to stand by him in difficult votes.
I know you pointed out that with the call to the Australian Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, John McCain, the senator from Arizona, same for Bob Corker, the senator from Tennessee, had called the U.S. ambassador, or called the Australian ambassador to the U.S. to try to smooth things over. Is that a role that lawmakers are okay with, or might they also at some point not pick up the phone?
I think they might not do so again if they see it as them getting President Trump out of trouble. One would assume that their patience with that would wear thin quite quickly. However, they might see it more as, in this case, shoring up a traditional American alliance, and therefore they might think of it not as a favor to President Trump, but as something that is important to do on its own terms.
Are his advisors, Mr. Trump's advisors, encouraging what he's done so far, or is this all Mr. Trump on his own, to get any sense?
I think that in general they are encouraging him down this path. I mean, there are clearly divisions and differences of tone and approach among certain advisors. Steve Bannon typically favoring a more combative approach. Reince Priebus, the White House Chief of Staff, less so. But I think in general terms his advisors are not unhappy with him continuing on a fairly combative course. As I say, that would certainly be Bannon's approach to matters.
Thanks, Niall. Niall Stanage, White House columnist at The Hill. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. So, picked later today, salad greens from Arizona could be in stores and restaurants as soon as tomorrow. But the path from farm to table is much more complicated, as uncovered by Arizona Republic investigative reporter Robert Englund. Robert, give us the basics.
Well, the basics are that if you're eating a salad anywhere in America right now, it probably came from Yuma. So the question is, how safe was it? And that's what we started with.
All right, so what'd you find?
Well, amazingly, a very rigid industry inspection process and audit process with very little federal oversight, very little, in fact, very little state oversight until it gets off the field. But when it comes to the field, the farmers have actually put together, there's a collective, and they do the inspections, and it's a hell of a thing.
Wow. So why so much detail and care?
Well, because in 2006, a E. coli outbreak that was traced back to spinach devastated the leafy green industry. Now, this was an outbreak that occurred in California, and it left hundreds of people ill and sick and caused some deaths. And the FDA at that point put out an alert that essentially said, don't eat spinach.
Mm, I remember that, yeah. So I know you said even as these guys walk the fields, if they spot an animal print, like a animal paw print, a red flag goes up. Explain that.
So, yeah, a single trace of poop in a field, either bird feces or animal feces or even a footprint, can cause the red flag's a good analogy. They create, what they do is they examine the footprint and find out whether or not the animal actually got into the field. If there was an incursion, they create a buffer zone around it, and then they inspect and they determine what they're going to do. And believe it or not, just a couple of months ago, they abandoned an entire field of lettuce because of they found deer feces in the field, and then they found out a fox was following the deer. And rather than risk it, rather than create a buffer zone where they just take out 5 feet, which is the typical buffer zone, they actually abandoned the entire field because the buyer there decided it wasn't worth the risk.
Wow.
And, of course, animals are usually the biggest carrier of E. coli feces.
Okay. So when they abandon an entire field, then what happens? They clear it out and replant or and then refertilize, or what happens?
Depending on the timing. In this case, I don't believe they had enough time to replant. But if they did, if it was early enough in the season, they could abandon the field, strip it, tear it out, and replant. Otherwise, they just move on to the next field, harvest it, and get the stuff to market.
Is that a reflection of how, say, economically devastating that last E. coli outbreak was in 06?
That's exactly what it is. And it nearly, for that season, it destroyed the spinach industry. And what the farmers say, that there's two collectives that I talk about in the story, a California and a Arizona one, and it's called the Leafy Green Marketing Agreement. And they say that they represent more than 90% of growers. And frankly, if you're not a member, you're going to have trouble selling lettuce. And you certainly can't, Canada will not take lettuce that's not grown by an LGMA member. That's how serious these audits are.
Thanks, Robert. Robert Anglin, investigative reporter at the Arizona Republic. 20 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. Most people groan at housework, embracing time-saving devices and products, right? Then there are those who deliberately increase their workloads by making their own household staples. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
Maybe it's to save money. Maybe it's to use fewer chemicals. Whatever the reason, more people are making their own laundry detergent, shampoos, and deodorants these days. Ellen Byron of the Wall Street Journal is here with a story. Ellen, is this something of a new trend, or has this been going on for a while?
Well, it's lately a trend in that people are sharing their approaches online, but people have been making their own cleaning products for generations, in part because there wasn't a lot available. But now, in this age of so many different cleaning products and beauty products that can tackle almost anything, it's remarkable that people still want to make their own.
And how complicated is the process? Take us through something like making a soap.
Well, definitely there are varying levels of complicated here. Some of the soaps simply involve mixing, let's say, washing soda and borax and perhaps some vinegar. And then others can actually take an entire afternoon because they involve blending ingredients, reaching precise temperatures, both on a stovetop and cooling. One liquid laundry detergent involves grating a bar of soap, dissolving the shavings into a simmering pot of water and pouring the mixture into a bucket and leaving that overnight. And then the next morning, stirring it again and pouring it into gallon dispensing jars. So there's a lot of choice as far as how complicated you'd like these to be.
Ellen, I would assume that the people you talk to like doing this stuff.
Oh, they love it, actually. All of the consumers I spoke with were very enthusiastic about doing these extra chores, frankly, mostly because they like the way their product performs better. Some of them also enjoy the cost savings or perhaps solving some health or environmental concerns that they have. But all of them were united in the idea that what they make, they like better and believe it performs better.
We're speaking with Ellen Byron of the Wall Street Journal about people who make their own cleaning products and makeup and things like that. You mentioned price. Is it actually cheaper, or in some cases, can this be more expensive than what you buy?
Some people did concede that it can get to be more expensive, especially as you use more and more essential oils for fragrance, for example. But by and large, people are finding ways, and they've been calculating it closely, that they can do a load of laundry or a load of dishes more cheaply using their own version.
I guess the big question, does this stuff work?
They say it does. They say that they're very happy with the performance, and indeed it performs better. However, I did talk to some senior scientists who are involved in making Tide laundry detergent. They're scientists from Procter & Gamble, and they walked me through the proprietary ingredients that Tide has. For example, they have surfactants and polymers that keep dirt from redepositing on clothes. They have enzyme systems to fight stains, and they emphasize that they have access to materials that DIYers working in their kitchen do not.
So do these companies have any concerns about people making their own products that will affect them in any way?
No, this is still a small group of consumers. However, I did find a company that was embracing this trend. OXO, which makes a lot of different household tools, they actually made a mop with a refillable bottle that lets consumers clean with whatever solution they want to use. So you can put a store-bought cleaner in this bottle, or you can make your own. And the brand even includes two recipes for floor cleaning solutions with the mop.
And you talked earlier about the rise of the internet in this whole thing. Can people go there and find recipes to make their own soaps?
Yes. I couldn't believe the variety and the availability of these recipes. And they're very enthusiastically shared and discussed by a lot of different bloggers. And again, many of them have different goals in mind. Some of them are very green-minded and are thinking about the sustainability of the ingredients that they're using and the energy that they require to make them. And then others believe that their ingredients help solve some health concerns that they have. And then yet others give extremely detailed breakdowns of the cost per use of their product versus commercial products.
That's this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka with Wall Street Journal reporter Ellen Byron. It is 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Transition seamlessly from presentation to meeting and from work to home with the Dell Latitude 13 7000 series, the laptop that takes care of business. The powerful performance and incredible battery life from this reliable business-class PC featuring Intel Core processors lets small business employees do their best work wherever work takes them. Learn more at Dell.com/radio. That's Dell.com/radio. Glad you could spend some time with us on This Weekend. Gordon Deal, Jennifer Koschenka, coming up this half hour. Avoiding those nasty gotcha fees from your car rental company. Making a Super Bowl ring so ordinary that you're not embarrassed to wear it. And how Warren Buffett decides what to eat for breakfast each day. That story in about 20 minutes. Well, craft brews have become so popular that lines of customers rival what you'd see for World Series tickets or a concert or Black Friday doorbuster sales. Fans queue up outside breweries for new releases of IPAs, in particular, a cloudy, unfiltered New England style that's loved for its flavors of citrus and tropical fruit. The fan base for these special edition ales has been growing since the early 2010s, creating excitement and a new revenue stream for the craft beer business, but there are hazards in these waiting lines. Joshua Bernstein wrote about it in the New York Times. Josh, explain the trend.
Yeah, typically you think of buying beer, you think you're going to go to a grocery store, you're going to go to your liquor store and you're going to pick up a six-pack. But there's been this sort of on-premise revolution where breweries have increasingly started selling beers directly out of their facilities. And so what this does is it sort of cuts out the middleman. So for young, small breweries just getting up and going, they're really able to kind of maximize profits because opening breweries is a very very intensive business to get into. And so this sort of thing has really enabled breweries to really make it happen. And the beers that are really sort of driving interest are IPAs or India Pale Ales. 10 years ago, we talked about IPAs. You'd think they're really bitter and citrusy and just sort of beers are very divisive for folks. But what's been happening over the last half decade or so is that in the New England region, there's been this the IPA has sort of been remixed to be softer, less bitter, more tropical. And it's a style that's really, people just go crazy for it. It's been amazing. So primarily, it's a style that also doesn't really sit well on shelves. And so, it's not going to be good 4, 5, 6 months later. So to get these beers the freshest, at their most fragrant, people are going directly to breweries to buy these beers that are typically sold in cans. And so it's just been this really fascinating phenomenon to watch this happen. Of course, it bubbled up in the Northeast and Vermont and Maine and New York City, but really it's just caught fire across the country. Now you're seeing breweries in L.A. and San Diego, Columbus, Ohio, Denver. I mean, everybody's making this style of beer right now, and it's really just captured drinkers' fancies. And I think part of the reason behind it, too, is bitterness really stops people, but you take away bitterness. But a lot of people love the flavors of papayas and mangoes and so on. And so this really gives people, there's a lot to love about the beer.
All right, so you mentioned that some of these lines – waiting to get into these places when a new beer is released can be like hundreds of people deep, or a line wrapping around in a couple of city blocks. How do the breweries manage that? There's got to be some safety concerns.
Totally. You know, it's less safety concern, more about managing concerns, so everybody really is able to, you know, everybody that waits in line gets access to the beer. So, you know, the folks at Oscar Blues had an issue where they didn't have line limits on there, and so someone went and bought $3,200 worth of beer, which is crazy. So, of course, everybody else couldn't get the beer, and they ran out very quickly. So what you're finding, like, other half has a wristband, so you wait in line, you get a wristband, so you can't have anyone cut in front of you. In Los Angeles at Monkish, they have people that scan your IDs. At Tired Hands outside Philadelphia, they have people that sort of, you know, police the lines to make sure everything is running orderly. And so it just sort of puts this whole other weight on the brewer's shoulders where, you know, you start a restaurant and you think, like, I'm going to make the best food possible. Then all of a sudden you have people clamoring at your doors to get in. And you have to figure out how to manage the line. Same thing with these breweries. It's such a new business model. And then, you know, no one opens up a brewery and thinks to themselves, here's how I'm going to write my business plan. Expect people to wait in line for 8 hours in the cold Saturday morning.
Right.
It's just, you know, it's something that's really come up organically. And it's this feedback loop for people. You know, when you get a taste of this beer, it really just, you know, people just clamor for it. And it's a challenge. You know, not every release is created equally. But, you know, there's some beers that people want more. Oftentimes, it's sort of the more intense, the bigger beers, which, like the double IPAs, which have a bit more alcohol, and oftentimes a more intense aroma and flavor to it, too. And those really get people out the doors as well.
Here's Josh Bernstein, writing for The New York Times. 21 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Here's something to consider if you'll be getting out of town on spring break and renting a car. What do you do when the exit on a highway has cashless toll booths? If you haven't read the fine print on your rental car agreement, you're in for a serious surprise. Luckily, there are workarounds. Here's consumer advocate Chris Elliott. Chris, what have you looked at here?
I was looking at a particular kind of gotcha fee, which is the fee that you have to pay when you go through a toll booth. You know, there are a lot of cashless toll booths out there. And, you know, if you have a rental car and your plate isn't registered or you don't have a transponder, then who's going to pay for it? And so that bill goes to your car rental agency. And guess what? The rental agencies have figured out a way of making money off that. They charge you not only for the toll, but also for the convenience of having one of their transponders. And it can really add up. I've talked to people who've spent literally hundreds of dollars on these transponders without sometimes even knowing that they were being charged for it.
Wow. Well, it shows how long it's been since I've rented a car that I would not be familiar with this. So explain how this works, because you say toll roads are opportunistically are built next to airports.
Oh, yeah. Oh, they absolutely are. And I cited Orlando and Miami, where you have two toll roads that lead to the airport, and those are usually the only ways of getting there. In some cases, they're the most obvious ways of getting to the airport. And then also Denver, if you're heading out to the mountains to go skiing, that there's a toll road leading from the airport back to Denver and then up to the ski resort areas. And so sometimes people will show up and they'll just, when they're renting a car, they'll just breeze right on through and they won't read any of the fine print. Well, that's a mistake, because in the fine print, you will find a warning about the toll roads and about what will happen if you go through one of these cashless toll booths. Mm. And what happens is that with some rental cars, they are going to start charging you the moment you go through the toll booth, and then for each day that you have the car, whether you use a toll booth or not.
Wow.
So you end up, if you're renting a car for like 7 days, you're going to get charged, I believe it's close to $5 a day for having that transponder in there. It can really add up.
Jeez, so that's triggered from the first time you go through one of these cashless plazas?
Absolutely. It's the first time you go through, and then they just keep the meter running, whether you use a toll road or not. It is a shameless cash grab, if you ask me.
Wow. We're speaking with consumer advocate Chris Elliott. He's written a piece called How to Avoid Gotcha Toll Fees from Your Rental Car Company. All right, so explain more of this, I guess. What kind of, defense do we have? Or is this all on us to ask questions and read the fine print?
Yeah, you have to read the fine print. I mean, you always have to read the fine print with a rental car, because they love to hide all kinds of things in there. One of the things that you can do, I talked to people who were very experienced at avoiding these fees. One of the things that they do is they don't rely on the GPS that the car rental companies give them, because those GPSs will take you to the toll roads. They want you to use those toll roads. So you use your cell phone and you use, you know, Google Maps to get you, and you choose the route that doesn't use toll roads, and so you avoid the toll roads. That's one way of doing it. The other way is to have your own transponder.
Mm.
And a lot of people will go to the grocery store, buy a transponder, register it to your rental car, and you're good. And then finally, the other way is to pay cash at the toll booth. There are still some roads that have toll booths that take cash or coins. Use those.
Thanks, Chris. Consumer advocate Chris Elliott. It's 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. Tom Brady now has a ring for his thumb after winning his fifth Super Bowl last Sunday, or you know, the middle finger on his other hand. But here's the thing. Super Bowl rings are so big, nobody wears them. Wall Street Journal sports writer Jason Gay says, with so many diamonds in detail, today's rings are about as understated as a Kiss concert. He says it doesn't have to be ridiculous and unwearable. Why not make something that can be worn out on the town? Jason, can you do this story without taking a shot at the Jets?
Gordon, I know you probably have a few Jets Super Bowl rings, don't you, in your collection?
Jeez, here we go.
Okay, well, probably not, but it's been a while. But, you know, back in the day, Gordon, the Super Bowl ring kind of resembled what you'd get for graduating high school. You know, a center stone, a little bit of writing on the side. But over time, it's become this crazy art installation that weighs about as much as a small dog. And what I really wondered is, the Super Bowl ring a ring anymore? And we talked to players, including Tom Brady, about it, and they don't wear them anymore. Tom Brady never wears the thing. The Patriots say they don't bring them out in public. They keep them locked up. It just seems absurd to me. It has no utility as a piece of jewelry. So the story is, should we make the Super Bowl ring a ring again?
All right. And so I know you talked to a handful of designers. What do they suggest?
Okay. Well, every jewelry designer would love a crack at designing a Super Bowl ring, right? You know, if you're making rings for a living, it's arguably the most significant culturally significant ring there is out there, right? I think everyone is in agreement that it probably needs to be pared down a bit. Now, there's some, you know, variance as to whether or not it needs to be, you know, shrunk down to a respectable wedding band style. I mean, I don't think anyone recommends that. Everyone says it's a Super Bowl, right? You want a sort of a significant ring. But I got some recommendations from designers about sort of signet style rings and things that are a little bit more wearable than what we see nowadays. I mean, have you seen what a Super Bowl ring looks like in 2000? Oh, you're a Jets fan, so you haven't seen one. But you have to trust me on this, Gordon, that they're massive and they're diamond encrusted and they look like something Damien Hirst would put into a British art museum. I mean, it's just absurd.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal sports writer Jason Gay. He's in Houston, where he has watched the Super Bowl. He's got a piece called "Let's Make Super Bowl Rings Better." Would the players be willing to wear something, say, smaller and less gaudier?
I think they'd be more inclined to wear it. Whether or not they want it is another story. I mean, if you're a Super Bowl, you know, if you're a professional football player, a Super Bowl ring is, you know, kind of the pinnacle of the experience, right? It's the best thing you can possibly get of your football playing career. And so I think that they want to have that significant bauble. But, I it would take a kind of Tom Brady type, or, you know, maybe basketball, LeBron James, to sort of be the pioneer to say, you know what, guys, we're going to tone it down this year. We're going to make something that we can, you know, wear out on the town. Now, if anyone's going to take that brave step, it would probably have to be a superstar athlete or an owner. I don't know if it's going to happen.
Thanks, Jason. It's Wall Street Journal sports writer Jason Gay. It's 7 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Reminder, by the way, that we can connect on social media. You can friend us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. We use the username @ThisMorningShow. If you like a little cynicism and sarcasm, you can follow me directly on Twitter with the username @GordonDeal. The new HBO documentary, Becoming Warren Buffett, shows the multitude of ways that the richest man on earth earned the title. It also shows the ways he manages the $74 billion in net worth. Mr. Buffett, who is 86, has the 5-minute drive from his home to the offices for his holding company, Berkshire Hathaway, in Omaha, Nebraska, every day. On that short drive, he makes a pit stop at McDonald's, as Business Insider explains. Then the stock market determines which breakfast he'll have. Every morning, he tells his wife how much exact change to put in the cup holder of his car. It's either in the amounts of $2.61, $2.95, or $3.17. He says when he's not feeling quite so prosperous, he might go with the $2.61. That's two sausage patties with a Coke. The $3.17 is a bacon, egg, and cheese biscuit. The $2.95 option is a sausage McMuffin with egg and cheese. After buying his breakfast, he eats the meal at his desk with his Coke. He pays retail, by the way, for cans of Coke, even though he's a shareholder. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.